In the legal world, knowledge is mostly shared through the written word, in briefs and judgments. But true wisdom, that's passed from person to person over time. Welcome to Elephant Echoes, a podcast that provides a platform for Bowman's legal veterans to pass their wisdom to the next generation of lawyers. I'm Bianca Masterton, a knowledge and learning lawyer in Bowman's Johannesburg office. As organizations such as Bowman's grow, evolve, and adapt, there is a risk of institutional knowledge being lost over time. This podcast is inspired by the great elephant herds and their complex and caring social structures. Our most experienced practitioners share their knowledge, skills, and insights as to how to become outstanding lawyers with flourishing practices. In this episode, Graham Demunt, a senior consultant based in our Johannesburg office, shares how he built a successful employment law practice.
I will share with you some ideas of how I went about building my practice. Hopefully, some of it may resonate with you. Obviously, there are very many different ways to build practices, and I'm not saying mine is the only way. It may just be some ideas that may work for you. So essentially, what I'm going to take you through is how I identified various niche areas in my practice and then developed an expertise and became effectively a thought leader in those areas of expertise, how I let people know that I was an expert and a thought leader in those areas, and then how I went about publishing and letting people, as I say, know that I did have this expertise. But most importantly, I'll share with you how I built a network of people and friends around me that actually have kept me working all of these years. So essentially, when I started practice in 1985, I've always generated largely my own work. And in the early years, I generated enough to keep me busy. I don't think I've had a quiet day in my practice. And in my latter years, I've been able to generate enough work for three or four lawyers. In the course of my career, I think I've worked with just about every major multinational and major company that there is. I've certainly covered a huge number of very large companies during the course of my career. So essentially, my core area has been employment law. But when I started in 1985, employment law was actually a niche area of dispute resolution because there wasn't very much employment law. Certainly nothing was known about employment law at the time, and we were just starting off. And one of the things that I did right from the beginning was align myself with a person who had a reputation and had a client base and obviously the knowledge and expertise, and that was John Brand, who was working with Bowman's at the time. So aligning yourself with somebody who already has the expertise gives you the ability to have a leg up essentially into a practice area. And it's always useful to identify somebody in that area that is an expert and has a reputation already. And that certainly helped. And John at the time had the COSATU trade unions as his client. And I don't know how I did it, but I managed to attract NACTU, which was the Black Consciousness trade union, to be my client. And so John and I had the COSATU and NACTU practices within Bowman's for many, many years. What then happened was that in the early 1990s, we were being funded out of Brussels by the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions to do all the work. And that work dried up. And because the funding dried up the moment that Mandela was released. So essentially, I found myself and John found himself without a substantial part of our practices. We did have a small employment practice left, but our entire trade union client base had to go elsewhere because we couldn't support it any longer. Now, at the time, we were starting to be used as a mediator in labor disputes. I was acceptable to both sides because I'd worked for unions. Employers thought I was acceptable to unions, so I was being used as a mediator. And I thought that the next big niche area was going to be alternative dispute resolution. So I developed expertise in alternative dispute resolution. I was a founding member of ADRASA, which was the forerunner of AFSA, which is still around today. But it was before its time, and I don't know why, but alternative dispute resolution never really took off. And so essentially that was a niche area that I chose to go into that turned out to be a dead end. I was continued to be used as a mediator, but it was a dead end essentially in terms of developing my career further. And that can happen. You can identify niche areas, you can go into them, and you may find somewhere along the line that actually that doesn't actually turn out. But you've got to at least try and identify them and move into those areas. What then started happening was that I started getting inquiries about pension law, and there were more and more sort of pension disputes arising in the sort of late 90s. I sort of recognized that this was going to become an area, again, another niche area that was aligned to employment law. So I developed, I read about it. Fortunately, I had clients paying for me to do a lot of my studying of pension law, but I developed expertise in pension law. And that then sustained me once I'd become a pension law and recognized, that sustained me for many, many years, right through probably 2012 and still to today. I do quite a lot of pension law. But that then also sort of brought in the entire employment benefit side of things. That's to do with medical aid, pensions, and more recently, long-term incentive schemes, share schemes. So I developed expertise in share schemes. And again, that niche area has turned out to be a very successful niche area for me in terms of work that I'm currently doing in that area. And executive dismissals, advising boards on executive dismissals, again, another niche area of employment law that I recognized. So essentially, I've always had employment law as my core area, but within it, I've identified niches where I can obtain expertise, where other people don't have expertise, where I go in and I can develop expertise, develop a reputation, and then attract work in that way. Now, how do you go about doing that? Well, clearly, you've got to read extensively. So I read extensively. I read The Economist so that I'm tracking trends. I'm seeing what's happening internationally. I'm reading all of those employment law cases that are coming through. I'm reading those legal briefs and stuff that come through. So you can see where your practice area is going, where things are opening up, where things are developing. So that is always what I've tried to do in my practice area. Somebody who's very good at identifying niche areas is Talita Lopsha in our practice area. What she's always done is been able to identify where things are going. So on employment equity discrimination, she's become an expert. She recognized that Poppy was going to be a big thing. She's developed an expertise in Poppy. Then again, with COVID and all of the stuff around COVID and the regulations, Talita has recognized that as a niche area and published, become an expert in it. And again, that's how she's developed a lot of her practice. So she's really good at that. Once you have identified your area, you need to become an expert in it, but not only an expert, you need to become a thought leader. And it really raises, well, what does it mean to be a thought leader? So an expert, you can report on the facts. You can see a case. You can say, this is what happened in this case. These are the facts. To be a thought leader, you've got to basically talk about what the law ought to be or the way the law ought to develop, but you ought to be thinking about what it should be and where we ought to go. So you're thinking out the box. You're not just simply reporting on facts. And that really is how you become a thought leader in your area. So now you're an expert and now you're a thought leader. But now how do you let people know that you are an expert and a thought leader? And I did it in two ways. So initially I did quite a lot of publications. So you'd write articles in terms of which you would develop a theme or talk about something and then essentially publish, but you've got to publish where you're going to be read by people who are going to use you. So if you publish, for instance, in De Rebus, you're likely to be read by other lawyers who are not going to be likely to use you. So I got quite a lot of publications done in publications like The Business Day or in the business section of The Star, where hopefully business leaders would be reading the stuff that you would be putting out there. Obviously now with the firm, there's a lot more availability for publication. The news flashes give you a fantastic opportunity to get into a wide client base who may well use you. There's podcasts, there's publications that are on the firm's website. But all of those are methodologies by which you can get out there. You've got to get people to know that you have the particular expertise that you have. And then I had participated in a lot of seminars and conferences and workshops and stuff like that. So obviously when I started off with employment law, it was a new area. It was novel. So people were interested in attending seminars. They were doing seminars in employment law. John Brand had a series going where it was a quarterly labor law update where we talk about cases. And I got to present on that seminars from way back in 1986. And to this day, I'm still doing the quarterly labor law update and speaking at those conferences. In those early days, I used to do the employment law updates. I got invited to do quite a lot of seminars. And then SASLaw, which is the Labor Law Lawyers Association, which attracts not only labor lawyers, but people who are interested in labor law to their conferences. I got invited to a couple of the SASLaw conferences to do presentations. When I became a pension law expert, the Pension Law Association was the sort of pension law association that looked after pension lawyers, but more importantly, invited industry people to come and listen to people talk on a variety of topics. And they had an annual conference, which was attended by between 300 and 400 people every year. And I got invited to speak at that in 2001. And then for the next 19 years, I got invited to speak at the Pension Law Association conference. And so those conferences are a fantastic way to workshop and show your expertise to the world. I know that public speaking isn't everybody's thing, but quite frankly, if you can develop the skills and are able to do speaking, you should do it because it is a sure way of letting people know that you do have that particular expertise. I was fortunate that the firm sent me on three overseas conferences run by what was called IPEBLA, which I think is the International Pension something. So I've sent overseas and I've presented on seminars overseas on three different occasions as well. So all of those are ways by which you now showcase the expertise that you have. Now, how do you get invited to participate in seminars? Well, obviously there are the firm seminars where they're being organized within, or if they're not being organized within, you'd be encouraging people to hold a seminar where you do have particular expertise and you can showcase it. And the firm has got a phenomenal client base that you can use to showcase your skills. So that is your obvious entry point. Your second obvious entry point is the associations. If you do have associations in your areas of expertise, we've been fortunate. We've got the SASLaw for labor law. We've got PLA for pension law. And there's SARA, which is now doing remuneration expertise. So I've been invited now to speak at the SARA conferences on share options schemes and things like that. So your associations are one way to get in. Now, how do you let them know that you are interested? I got myself onto the Pension Law Association governing body. I got elected onto that. The next thing I knew, I was president of the PLA for some point in time. Now, obviously, if you're president of the PLA or you're on the governing body, you have access to the seminars that are being presented and you're able to put yourself forward, or other people will put you forward on your behalf, but you're known. So that was a very useful methodology by getting involved in the actual associations. When the conference committees of the associations, when they're organizing conferences. But also the BD department can put you in touch with the commercial seminar organizers who are putting on commercial seminars as well. So there are various methods by which you can let people know that you are interested in putting forward. But for me, the biggest way that I grew my practice was by my network of clients who used me. And I never had a plan to build a network. I never had a methodology or thought. Now, every year I'd go away at Christmas and I'd think about the strategy for the following year and I'd write down some thoughts, and invariably I'd forget about it by February, by the time we'd got busy. And then the next time I thought about it was when I sat down at Christmas the following year. I did make conscious decisions to move into niche areas, like pension law was a conscious decision. ADR was a conscious decision, and the share options have been conscious decisions. So I've made those. I didn't make conscious decisions about building my network. It just happened. What happened was that basically I made friends with people that I met. The conferences were an incredibly useful way to meet people, because there what's happening is you've got like-minded people, the people who are in your area and are looking for lawyers to work with. And I struck up friendships with people I met at the conferences. So, you know, the conferences, you'd always have tea breaks, you'd have lunch breaks, and particularly the conferences that were away conferences where you had an evening away. Or overseas, the Apebla conferences were phenomenal because there were South Africans from the, like Alexander Forbes, Liberty, Momentum were all represented at those conferences. And I met their people there because the South Africans tended to congregate together. So I'd meet them and we'd do things together. But in doing things together, we developed friendships. You started talking beyond the law. You started talking about your personal lives and children and various activities and interests and things like that. I developed personal friendships. And, you know, once you've developed that connection at a conference with somebody, you've sat down, you've had a tea or you've had a lunch, you've established a personal connection. It's easy enough to say, let's have lunch together. Let's have coffee together, whatever it may be. And nobody's ever going to reject you for if you suggest having a lunch or having a coffee. And then the friendship develops. And I never set about establishing these friendships with a view to getting work. I established them because I liked the people that I was meeting and they liked me, and we established a rapport. In the course of those friendships, I never pitched for work. I never denigrated the lawyers that they were working with. I never asked for work. I simply was a friend. The other way I built my network was, oddly enough, and again, this was not a plan, but through Bowman's lawyers that I worked with that went elsewhere after leaving Bowman's. And they remained loyal to me. So people like Sim Chabalala, who's chief executive of Standard Bank, has been incredibly loyal to me right throughout. It's, you know, if there's an issue involving Sim at Standard Bank, then I get involved. Patrice Motsepe, another example of somebody who's been incredibly loyal to me. Dansa Malamba, president of the Gauteng High Court, been a close friend over many, many years. And there are others, Nadira Diana Rain, who's gone off to APSA, various other people have continued to use me. And I think the reason why is that I was decent to them. I treated them with respect. I never, ever treated my juniors in a disparaging or belittling or horrible way. I was always respectful. I was always decent to them. And I think that's all that required, is that somebody was decent, recognized them, behaved in a decent way, and then they remained loyal to you. Those were sort of how I built my network. And eventually, you know, it became quite an extensive network of friends. As I say, I had a lot of lunches, but it kept me, as I say, going for years in terms of the referrals of work that I received out of this group of people that I made friends with. And then obviously it's about your attitude. I mean, I've always been accessible, so I'm accessible to my clients. I don't, even if I'm on leave, I'll take a call. And if I can't do the work, I'll put them onto somebody who can actually look after them. But I will take that call. I'm responsive, so I'll get back to people quite quickly, and I'll deliver in terms of what I say I'll deliver. So I respond very quickly. I think it's incredibly important that you're personable, that you're easy to get on with, that you relate, and as I say, that you're able to sort of move the conversation and have something beyond the work, that you can move to a personal conversation where there can be some sort of rapport. Then, you know, the other things, I mean, these are just small things I've done, is that, you know, if there's a case of interest, if there's an article of interest, I'll send it to a client. So I'm front of mind with them on these particular issues. So it's really, I suppose, if I look back, and I've had an incredibly fortunate career, I've really been phenomenally privileged. I've been privileged with the clients that I've worked with. I've been incredibly privileged with the matters that I've handled, some of the incredibly complex matters that we've settled or gone to the Constitutional Court or had to deal with in the SCA. Privileged with the incredible people I've worked with within Bowman's and my colleagues that I've worked with. And again, I've never disparaged my colleagues who in other firms. I attribute it to what I've described to you, is that I've had a core area, which is employment law. I've identified niches within it. I've become an expert and a thought leader in those areas. I then let people know I have that expertise by publishing and particularly by talking. I've done a lot of seminars and a huge number, and it's important to invest in those seminars by building this network of friends and doing it purely on a friendship basis without expectation. I've never ever done it on the basis I expect you to give me work in due course. I've done it because I like these people. I developed a rapport. I enjoyed my interactions with them. I enjoyed my lunches. And again, I've always treated my juniors with respect and decently. I hope for those of you who are on the line who may disagree, I apologize, but I certainly hope that I've treated you with respect.
Thank you, Graham. So fantastic. There is one question on the chat, if I can perhaps raise that with you, from Sabu. What advice can you provide a young lawyer like me who may struggle to connect and form friendships with older potential clients due to the age gap?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, this age gap business. My first friend, real friend, was a guy called Phil Cohen at PG Glass. And Phil was my father's age. And he became a confidant and mentor to me. He gave me a lot of advice as a young man, as a young lawyer. And we were great friends, absolutely great friends. And if you're brave enough to have those kind of conversations, it's actually surprising who you relate to. Quite a lot of it is an ability to be intimate. It's a challenge to be intimate, to show a little bit of who you are as a human being. It's a brave step to do it, because we always feel vulnerable if you make a step. So if you've got to say to someone, this marriage business is hard, to open a conversation and on a more personal level. But you'll be surprised that if you take that step, the response that you get, people will then start engaging with you. So there are various ways. Certainly for me, the way that I engaged was an ability to be intimate, to say stuff that was intimate to me, to share stuff that was happening for me. And then in return, you would find that they would share stuff that was happening to them, and the conversation would begin. Obviously, if there's shared interests, if you've got an interest in sport, or you've got an interest in children, or whatever it is, there's a conversation that can be had that is not necessarily intimate, that is more comfortable for you. So it's worth exploring. It's worth trying with everybody, with ages, genders. Just try, and you'll be surprised at the response. That's for me is how you do it. I know it's not easy. It's a challenge, and you've got to reach within yourself, and you've got to reach out. But, you know, certainly it helped for me. I'd say in the early days, I was probably not as open as I am now. You feel that much more vulnerable. You protect yourself more. I think once you've had your midlife crisis, you'll become more vulnerable. You don't care. You will be more intimate. You will be prepared to share more. But yeah, so those are just a few ideas in terms of what I would suggest, that what worked for me. But, you know, certainly the age gap was not a problem with, certainly when I think back on Phil Cohen, and it kind of, he almost became a father figure to me in many respects in terms of the mentorship advice that he provided to me and the conversations we had. And a lot of it was repartee and fun, and we just laughed and joked and whatever.
Thank you. I don't know, is there anyone else that has any questions for Graham?
Hi, Graham. Graham, what staggers me about you is your ability to get back to people on time. And, you know, you're talking about all of these efforts that you make to have lunch and to have these opportunities of engagement. I'm just interested to know how you manage to find that time under circumstances, particularly where you have a practice that is so overwhelmingly busy with so many demands. How does that leave you time to do anything for yourself?
Look, the most important thing is having a support structure of lawyers that you work with. And I've been incredibly fortunate with the lawyer support structure that I've had around me. The firm has been phenomenal in terms of the lawyers that it's given me to work with. I've had the most incredible lawyers. So, you know, if you've got people who can do the work around you to do the actual physical work, and you are the client-facing person, it's relatively easy to make the time, because you need to get the work out and off your desk to other people who are absolutely more competent in many respects to do the work than you are. I mean, my drafting is terrible. I'm not a good draftsman. I can write opinions. I can do that type of stuff. But don't ask me to draft a contract. Get the work down to the people who can do the work, and then you will find that you've got the time to answer the calls, to make sure that you get back to clients and that you are responsive. But it's a team effort. It's never just one person. It is the entire team. And so they're the guys who deliver. And then I'm able to take the call, respond, have the conversation, always ensure again in the conversation that you go beyond the work, ask them how they are, what's happening, you know, type of stuff, so that you create that personal link. I think the personal link is absolutely critical. I mean, there was an interesting article in one of those Malcolm Gladwell books about how, you know, a doctor who spends 10 more minutes with his client just talking about their lives is, I think, is like 80% less likely to ever be sued by his client when he gets it wrong. It's that personal conversation and making the time for that personal conversation beyond the work. How are you? How's life? What's happening? You know, it's easy. It's easy to have those conversations, take them beyond the norm, and they make all the difference. I think doctors call it bedside manner, but it's all the difference is those extra 5 minutes, 10 minutes that you spend asking about them and then listening to the answer, remembering the answer, so that the next conversation you can build on that as well. And not talk about yourself, which is what I'm busy doing.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I think that has been invaluable for all of us, and, you know, really some actual concrete steps people can follow in their own practices and their own day-to-day lives. So thank you so much for your time. I truly appreciate it.
And thank you all for the opportunity. I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
If you would like to get in touch or find out more about Bowmans, please visit BowmansLaw.com.